One of the most significant things about the controversy over the Supreme Court is one class or group. The list of those willing to stand up and be counted includes many prominent names, and foremost among them are college presidents, the heads of great universities, teachers and students of government. After all, we confront in this issue a problem of government, and surely we are constrained to listen respectfully to the urgings of men who have given much of their lives to the study of social and political science. One of these men is to talk to you today. He is Wilfred I. King of the Department of Economics at New York University. May I present Dr. King.
The United States, like most other nations, has a constitution. I wonder if most of us have ever really stopped to ask why. An obvious answer is that the constitution is needed to describe the setup of the government. However, our constitution goes much further than this. It provides for a complete system of checks and balances. It carefully limits the powers of Congress and the President. It safeguards the system by making the process of amendment slow and difficult. Why did the makers of the Constitution deem it necessary to introduce these latter features? It would have been much simpler merely to give all power to Congress and let its legislation be the supreme law of the land. The fathers of our government took these precautions because they were living in an age which believed it worthwhile to hearken to the voice of experience. Both their own observation and the history of the past taught them the weakness of any system of government which was immediately responsive to the wishes of the public. They believed that the carefully considered judgment of the people was likely to be wise, but they had no faith in the soundness of popular whim. The Constitution was deliberately designed to make the public follow the precept, look before you leap. The makers of the Constitution also believed in the principle of specialization. They did not consider it advisable for every man to be his own jeweler, his own carpenter, his own physician, and his own lawyer. They did not assume that every cobbler was competent to make laws for the nation. They realized that the people's representatives in Congress would not be free to use their best judgment in making laws, but would be compelled to yield to the clamor of their constituents. The founding fathers therefore arranged for a group of experts to pass finally upon the validity of the laws enacted by Congress, to see that these laws conformed to the spirit of the Constitution. They called this body the Supreme Court. They did their best to free it from popular pressure. But the things I am describing happened a century and a half ago. Great changes have taken place. Education has come to the masses. Has not the public now gained such poise and balance as to make these precautions antiquated and obsolete? The best way to answer this question is to see how we have recently behaved. In 1918, we embraced prohibition with every evidence of enthusiasm. A decade later, we repealed the amendment with equal gusto. In 1928, we had such confidence in foreigners that we lent them money without thinking it necessary to examine their collateral. In 1936, we considered the man who had proposed lending money abroad as being little better than an imbecile. In 1928, we elected Mr. Hoover by an overwhelming majority. In 1932, we threw him out by a similar majority. In 1929, we believed in a new era of permanent prosperity. In 1932, we were convinced that we were in a new era of permanent depression. The evidence indicates that schooling hasn't changed us much after all, and that it still is wiser to rely upon our sober second thought than upon our snap judgment. In the last 150 years, the complexity of government has greatly increased. Now everything is done on a vast scale. Franklin Roosevelt's administration actually spends more in a single day than Thomas Jefferson's did in 2 years. Under these circumstances, it is obviously necessary either that all the voters be expert economists, or that, in the last analysis, government be supervised by a committee of experts. Economics is a more difficult subject than engineering. We would not think of building a bridge without placing a supervising engineer in charge. We would not expect a popular vote on the thickness of the girders to give a sound basis for bridge construction. It's equally unlikely that a popular vote can be depended upon to provide a safeguard in questions of economics. But both Congress and the President are ever subject to popular pressure. The only body that thus far has been freed of basic actions upon scientific principles is the Supreme Court. We are told, however, that the Supreme Court is reactionary, that it is blocking the path of progress. We are told that the nine justices are too old to keep pace with the spirit of the time. What are the facts? It is indeed true that they are too old to be swept off their feet by every economic and political ism which is, for the moment, catching the public fancy. It is also true that they still adhere to the antiquated idea that we may be able to learn something from the experience of the past. There can be little doubt but that they look with favor upon a political system which has given us the greatest personal liberty consistent with order, and which, during the last century, has quadrupled the real income of the average citizen and of the common working man. They like that they are prejudiced in favor of this system, which makes real wages in the United States 4 or 5 times as high as in Russia, the land of the planned economy. Time was when such beliefs and prejudices would have been considered virtues. But the President would have us believe that the members of the Supreme Court have been engaged in sacrificing the masses to the classes. What are the facts? What did their decisions indicate? They overthrew the NRA, an act which attempted to raise wage rates. But any trained economist will tell you that raising wage rates increases the cost of the products of labor, lessens the sales of such products, and produces unemployment. Reference to any adequate fiscal record shows that the NRA blocked recovery and that its appeal was marked by an immediate and continued upswing in business and increase in employment. By this decision, the court helped the laborer as much as the independent employer. Furthermore, it restored to the average citizen one of his most cherished rights, the right to engage freely in enterprise. No longer could a man be sent to jail for making and selling a loaf of bread or a radio battery. No longer could monopoly hide behind the skirts of government and proceed to fleece the consumer with the full sanction of the law. The Supreme Court also invalidated the AAA and thus terminated the program of destruction of crops and farm animals, which is increasing the cost of living to consumers everywhere, and its careful statistical investigation proves not only to have been of no benefit to the farmers, but to have wrecked their foreign markets. Once more, the Supreme Court's action was in accord with the principles agreed upon by the great body of economists. The court also held unconstitutional the Guffey Coal Act. Here again, it acted to restrain the large coal producers and the labor unions from forming a joint monopoly to levy tribute upon all those consuming coal. And this means, directly or indirectly, nearly the entire population of the United States. The Supreme Court has repeatedly objected to attempts by Congress to use the Interstate Commerce Clause or the taxing power as cloak to enable it to interfere with freedom of contact. Those who condemn the court for such interference rightly overlook the fact that freedom to buy and sell goods and services is the very essence of the system which has made American prosperity the envy of the world. Those who condemn the court as reactionary seem to be suffering from the delusion that economics is a change in science. The truth is that many of the fundamental laws of economics were applicable in the animal world long before man appeared upon Earth. The beaver was familiar with the necessity of saving. Ants engaged in agriculture. The laws of economics were then as applicable then as now. Like the laws of mathematics, economic principles are immutable. It is their application that changes the changing world. We do not need, therefore, to worry lest the justices are applying an outworn system of economics to a new situation. As a matter of fact, most of the essentials of the New Deal are anything but new. They are merely repetitions of measures oft-tried and oft-found wanting. For centuries, Europe experimented with regulation of prices and wages. But its prosperity began when freedom took the place of control. Virginia, from 1610 to the Revolution, in an endeavor to bring prosperity to the tobacco industry, experimented with most of the devices later used in the AAA, but none of the measures were successful. To call the justices reactionaries because they failed to enthuse over attempts to revive devices repeatedly discredited by past experience is to misuse the term. In reality, the Supreme Court may best be thought of as the body which upholds reason against emotion, science against guesswork, experience against ignorance. Furthermore, it is the one section of our government which has shown any continuing disposition to safeguard those fundamental rights of man which are wrested from parents at great cost in suffering and blood. Are we, the citizens of the United States, willing to sit by supinely while the guardian of our freedom is destroyed?
Thank you, Dr. King. You have just heard Wilfred I. King of New York University describe the danger that lurks in the plan to attack the Supreme Court. Write to your senators and congressmen today, urging them to oppose this measure. Send to this committee, the National Committee to Uphold Constitutional Government, of which Dr. King is a member, for a copy of this address, or for petitions and other material on this issue. Address the National Committee to Uphold Constitutional Government at 205 East 42nd Street, New York City, or its chairman, Mr. Frank E. Gannett, in care of the Times Union, Rochester, New York.